drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Dara O'Brien has been described as Britain's favourite Irishman. It's probably safe to say he's Ireland's favourite Irishman too. He's a fast-talking comedian who likes to target politicians and beautiful Irishmen. More on that later. Over the next week, Australians will get a chance to see the man once described as the 16th funniest comedian in Britain, which is pretty funny in itself. Dara is touring the East Coast with his Voice of Reason show. He's in the drawing room with me now. Falshare Roash.
Okay. Falcha wrote is what you're trying to say.
Gave that a red hot go, and you've just mocked me.
I think you were given a bum steer on the phonetics. I know what was happening in the middle of the Roash.
I don't know what was happening. I tried my best. As I say to my kids in class, it's just about trying.
Yes. Yeah.
You tell us. Say it again, so we can hear you.
Falcha wrote. Falcha wrote.
And it means 100,000 welcomes.
It's spelled exactly as it said, which is F-I with an accent above an
I don't actually have the correct spelling.
R-O-M-H-A-T is how we spell wrote.
Well, I'm glad I got it wrong, because didn't we start off on a funny note?
Honestly, I'm really glad you went for it, because it is, it's always a pleasure to hear Irish, even if I had to...
Even if someone murdered it
reverse,
to death.
Reverse engineer it back into what it was. But yes, it's
well, can you say hello in Greek?
I cannot actually say hello
exactly.
In Greek at all. So there.
But am I mocking you?
But equally, I wouldn't try. What is hello in Greek? Is that interesting?
Yasu. We're here to talk about your comedy, but I also want to find out a little more about your interest in science, because I understand as a kid your dream was to meet your hero Stephen Hawking, and you did it.
I did do it, because I was about 16 actually when the book came out. So it was an important part of my life, that and other popular science books. I remember once talking to some other science people and actual scientists once about at a presentation of the Royal Society's Science Book of the Year, going, what age were you when you read the book that made you? Mm. And they were and across the board, 14. 14 was the age that they read a book about whatever field they were currently in, and they went, oh my, and their brain kind of went, that's a thing. I like the sound of that. I think we should spend the rest of our lives getting into that, like whatever. And this was an astronomer and an immunologist, and they'd all read something, a chemist, some book had hit them at 14, like whatever. So Hawking was around about that time, 14, 15, maybe 16. And then I did get to meet him, and that was a tremendous privilege.
So at 14, did you read about science and also comedy on the side?
No, do you know, the comedy thing all came later. I mean, comedy I was just enjoying because comedy was on. Like, it was a fun thing to do, but I never had any delusions that I would end up being a comedian. It seemed like that's as unthinkable as you can imagine. Only when I went to university that I stood in front of audiences doing debates and would pepper them with jokes, and the jokes seemed to go very, very well. And when they did, I used to get this huge surge of, wow, there's an adrenaline rush. Where did that come from? Honestly, it was like totally blindsided me, the job I'm in now. To a certain extent, 28 years later, I'm still relatively surprised that this is what I do rather than something else. And there are many others who will be surprised as well.
Many others.
The acclaim of the population going, really? You call yourself a comedian?
So what made you, you were obviously loving the adrenaline.
Yeah.
And
honestly, that's it.
That and is the love. You're loving the love,
that's
right?
Why you do it. You just enjoy the rush. You do it for the thrill. It's amazing. You're getting the laugh. A bunch of strangers, particularly if you've come off being a teenage boy, you know, and being all that kind of insecurity and shyness and all that, like whatever, you're kind of emerging from that in university, and suddenly you find, wow, I can wow an audience. And also you view audiences as a collective animal. And you go, oh, look, that room of people who are all sitting patiently waiting for a lecture, if I had 5 minutes in front of them now, I could get them to make a noise, which would be very nice. And so it becomes that. Like, a lot of comedians weren't the class clown. It wasn't a thing that they were there.
I know. It's strange. I've found that. And it's, they weren't like the funny guy.
No, they weren't. And the funny guy doesn't end up being a comedian. The funny guy ends up being the funny guy in the office, or the funny guy in his car dealership, or whatever the funny guy ended up working in. And he will always be that funny guy, but that's not the same skill. It's weird. It's very different. What works in front of an audience and what works just, you know,
with your
talking.
Mates.
Yeah, it's very different.
You've gone from TV shows for kids to comedy panel shows. You even did a series called Three Men in a Boat, where you an Irishman, we've mentioned that a few times, joined two other comedians, a Welshman and a Scot, in a trip. Tell me about that. What was that all about?
Well, see, it started with the novel. I mean, intermittently people will do versions of Three Men in a Boat. And so we were, let's say, this generation's turn. I got three comedians. Griffiths Jones, who was part of the Not the 9 o'clock News, and then Alas Smith and Jones. Roy McGrath, who was also part of that kind of generation. And then they got me. And this is like 15 years ago now, whatever. So I was very, very new. And they got us to do the skiff trip that you do down the Thames, which follows the book, which meant then I went and read the book. And it is basically, it's a long stand-up routine. Mm. It just goes off into digressions of how his uncle hanging a painting and it's a great comic novel because there's no novel there. There's no story. Midway through the return journey, they just go, oh, sod this, like, and they get the train back to London and they, you know. And so it's perfect it's just a series of digressions linked loosely by a boating journey with an imaginary dog. Apparently the whole thing is all fictitious. So we did that journey and we did a week of, in fact, 9 days of slowly puttering along the Thames, having low peril adventures and just enjoying it and having fun with the thing in this incredibly bucolic countryside that England delivers, and, you know, the river wending its way to high banks of hills and trees, and it was all gorgeous. And we kept finding these little communities of people and weird little sub stories appearing, and it was a lovely thing. And then we spent 10 days filming it, got as far as Oxford. There was a car waiting to bring us home at the end of the drink. We had a couple of drinks and then drove home in an hour. It took 10 days to get to Oxford, and I was at home by 11 o'clock. So it remains, as I say, a weird dream. Did that actually happen? Did we take 10 days to do an hour's journey? And then once we'd done that, it went very, very well, and they got us to do out the Thames the other way and down the south coast, and then to the Scilly Isles. We did across Ireland. We did along the Dalmatian coast in Croatia into Venice. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've done a few of those travel documentaries.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. You're in the drawing room. Dara O'Brien is my guest. He's been described as Britain's favourite Irishman. He's a comedian and he is touring the East Coast with his Voice of Reason show. So stand-up comedians are notorious for mining their personal lives, of course, for content. I mean, you know, what else do you mine?
Yeah.
Who is the biggest source of material for you and your family?
It's generally myself rather than the family. I have surrounded myself with the people I love, with people who have no desire to feature in any way. Mm. And that does somewhat limit it. My sister would murder me.
Yeah, okay.
My wife is the thing I'm supposed to have said was very funny, so fine, like whatever, because I would go, and then my wife said, and there'll be a topper, and she'll go, right, I don't quite remember saying that, but I'm happy to let that slide. Like, so they know it's quasi-fictional and thing, but usually you shouldn't cling to there being too much truth in this stuff. I mean, as long as there's an emotional truth, as long as there's a basis in it, let it then spiral off into whimsy and nonsense. And so I'm not pouring my heart out and going, this is, I mean, if a story emerged that was perfect and heart-wrenching and I'm not saying I wouldn't do it and it wouldn't be a nice thing, but the thing is, if you find something that is a story in which the emotions are genuine ones of anger or sadness or whatever, that feels like a very true and honest thing to do on stage. Except when you do a tour, you're going to repeat it 177 times for 2 years. And
I've always felt a lot of repetition.
Yeah, and it also does feel like at some point, the honesty of that moment might get cynically washed away into just you repeating the words to get the same reaction. And I know that there's something about being able to perform that over and over again is part of the job. But it does feel to me like I remember being on stage once just after my grandmother had passed away. And God, she was 100 years old. It was a fine thing. But I was on stage that night because of the night of the funeral, because I had to go down to a comedy festival. I was at. And I told the story to the audience. And it was, you know, there was an element of it being, people gave you the extra gravity of you've just attended a funeral. And I told stories about her life and all that. And it was a nice moment, like whatever. But I kind of went, I can't repeat this over and over again because I can't get back into that, and it feels like I'd be contriving a fake emotion for the sake of the material. And so a lot of the time it's easier to come up with nonsense whimsy and do that way, yeah.
You open up about your life as a middle-aged man in this particular show.
Mm-hmm.
The world is changing. How is life treating middle-aged men right now? How are middle-aged men going?
Oh, you know, we're the real minority.
Yeah, you're suffering. I can see immensely.
Absolutely. It's the invisibility. That's when the really hurts, like whatever. And I say, and I'll discuss that in Hamer Hall for the 2,500 people.
Yeah, suffering.
Shoot me if I ever say that stuff genuinely, like whatever. I mean, there is an end to which I think as you get older, you certainly disappear out of a world which favours youth anyway. I mean, it's been given a different cast because, in the sense that there's a generation that we've been hearing your voice for so long now, and that's time for a more diverse voice to come through, which, by the way, is absolutely right. It's grand. And I think there's a possibility of conflating those two things, a general movement towards broadening out the access to other voices, as simply as that, like whatever. And the fact that as you get older anyway, that's just a fact of life, like whatever it's got. Somebody put it very, very sweetly once and said he was out with his son, his grown son, and there was a waitress there, and the waitress was just flirting with his son and then was like, yeah, and what do you want? And then we come back to the son, like, and he was going, oh my God, I've totally disappeared, like whatever. And you're going, yeah, that is part of going out. But I think the problem is if you go and you take that natural phenomena and something that we can all lament, I think as we get older, we become less... Whatever relevance is supposed to be, we lose it with this being, we're being pushed out in favour of, you know, diverse and minority voices. Like, well, those are not the same two phenomena. One I have total respect for, and the other is not actually a proper complaint to make. The more voices, the better in what I do, especially because in TV shows I do over in England, like Mock the Week, whatever, more people feeding in. It's always a better show when more people are feeding in. If people are feeding in different things, then funnier stuff happens. There are more things to connect to. Same principle by which you talk to an audience in a theatre. I'm good at telling stories. You know, I can do that pretty well. But if there's 2,000 people in front of me collectively, odds are they've got good stories too, like better stories than I will ever come up with, like whatever. So, yeah. But listen, you get older, that's going to happen, like there. Yeah. This is the thing. I mean,
no real avoidance.
You can't. And also, pointedly, if you're working show business, of course you're going to become less relevant. As this is a world that loves novelty and newness, like whatever, and that's going to happen. I mean, we're very lucky comedians that the slope down is much more gentle than most other showbiz industries. If I was in a band, I'd be stacking shelves by this stage and reminiscing to people in the storeroom. Like, that's how quickly bands come and go. But I've managed to you can hit a plateau. Like whatever. And also what's happened in the last while, digital technology has changed stand-up comedy particularly, because it's taken away the DVDs that we used to release. And there was always a thing at the end of a tour, you'd release a DVD for the Christmas market or whatever. They don't exist anymore because nobody's buying DVDs. So the tours can go longer and at a more steady pace. And no big mad rush to finish it. So the tours can go longer. But the clips appear now because of the same internet, clips appear all over the world. So hence I'm doing an interview now and sitting in a studio in Melbourne with you. Oh, sorry, in a drawing room. So now... tours that you would do just in the UK and Ireland, I'll do 25 countries. So right at a point where maybe I'd be feeling exhausted with this thing, whatever, suddenly this whole international element came along to a stand-up career, which has given this burst of energy to it. So I'm, yet again, incredibly lucky, because now I will do the show in Reykjavik and Moscow and Melbourne and Wellington.
Got to ask the most obvious question on that one, actually. Yeah. It's a very obvious question, but I am fascinated by this. Did the jokes get a different response in, say, Melbourne versus somewhere in Russia?
Russia is a specific case, let's say.
Please tell me more.
Yeah, the Russian one was bizarre. Broadly, no, they get the same response everywhere. People is people everywhere. And so it doesn't mean from Reykjavik to... There are other things that you can touch on more and have fun with. I mean, obviously, if you go to Reykjavik, that's just fun anyway. There are literally Vikings who live on a rock. So they're fun anyway as people. But no, it doesn't change that much from place to place. Moscow, I did once before in 2014, and we tacked it on at the end of a tour. The DVD was already out at that stage, but we thought, we'll go to Moscow. That'd be great. We'll do that. We'll show them Moscow. And... I did some messing around coming out. It was all going very, very nicely. And then I segued very smoothly into the first joke of the show, let's say. So let's move on with the show. And I did the first joke and I got nothing. And if you're very new, you go, God, I'm dying here. And you get nervous. And as you get older, you realize, no, wait, hang on, that's weird. Why would that not get it? Why would that particular... the thing in that joke not be funny here? So let's find out. And so you go, hey, why didn't you laugh at that? Like, whatever. And... a man raised his hand in the second row, and I still to this day I would always remember his smiling, warm face. And I said, "What is it? Why did you not get that?" And he said, "We know that one. We know all of your stuff. We know all of your stuff. The minute a DVD would get released, it would get ripped and translated into Russian. So these are big, and there's like 900 people in the theatre, all comedy nerds, massive comedy nerds, had seen everything I'd ever done." So on stage, I had to try to remember stuff from before we recorded DVDs. And the first half was not great.
Did you remember that you had to pivot? You were like, oh no, go pre-DVD, go pre-DVD.
No, that was on, oh no, that'll be on thing. And trying to remember. And the way it works with these, when you've got material, you can remember about 3 hours material. You can remember the show you're doing and a bit of the previous show. right? And maybe a couple of other jokes from earlier on. And then what it is when you write a new show, it just shunts it along. Mm. So your memory can only hold so much. And I'm trying to both remember and write at the same time. And first half wasn't great, and the second half was furiously writing down things and go, what did I used to do in 2005? And then remember it is. And then I had to go back out with this old stuff, like whatever, including jokes about a trip to Heron Island in 2001. There was a routine I was wrote about that when I visited Heron Island here. It was like 15-year-old material that I had to come out and had to finish with that, like whatever. And it went brilliantly.
They hadn't seen that one.
But they'd seen every other thing. So everywhere in the world, honestly, I've yet to play America, because America's this weird domed area that you don't get into unless you really, dig your way in. So I've not bothered with the effort of doing that. But for the rest of the world, the rest of the globe, everyone's exactly the same except Moscow.
It's good to know. Good to know.
Yes,
this is
bear that in
the
mind.
Facts that I need to know. Hey, I have to touch before I let you go on politics, because you do. You have a bit of fun with politics.
We do.
And there's quite a lot of opportunity at the moment, isn't there, in your world?
Well, in the sense that the country in which I do a topical comedy show is self-immolating at the moment.
Yeah, it appears to be the case.
Yes.
So Boris Johnson, who is who's the new Prime Minister,
yes,
right?
Our glorious leader.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
How's that
honestly,
going?
I'll check my phone, see if he still is. Like at any moment that might have stopped. We live in bizarro world where everything is strange and wrong at the moment. Mm. But
the thing is with Trump, right? I've interviewed lots of comedians about Trump who say it's impossible to do comedy with Trump because he's just...
So self-parodying.
Yeah. And I find that very, very intriguing that you can't even find a spot to kind of get funny with him.
Yeah.
But can you with Boris Johnson?
You can a bit more with Boris Johnson. Trump is a bit like doing jokes about The Simpsons, if you know what I mean. Like it's already a comedy. It's already really broad and whatever. How can you add into it? Johnson has been, but the problem with Johnson was that he was treated as such an amusing joke for so long that then the swerve to him actually becoming the leader it's almost like it's softened him and made him more palatable for the kind of people who voted for him in this leadership election. So people are now wary of even doing Johnson and in fact I'm now making a point of saying Johnson because even the fact that everyone refers to him as Boris has kind of just made him more electable when his politics are ridiculous. The whole flubba lubba lubba thing.
But he's hilarious.
Yeah, do you know, it turns out not that funny. His first couple of things weren't that good, and then he had terrible speech standing in front of some police officers where he just seemed to go bad. So it's I think people aren't enjoying the show that they thought they'd been promised.
The show's been really
oversold. Yeah, it was a good audition and it turns out in the actual job, not so much. So it's a pleasure to be here for a while. Just to see this from a distance.
Now, let me ask you before we go, if politics can be thought of as a beast, let's head to beauty, right?
Okay.
Let's work in binaries here. You like to talk about the rise of the beautiful Irish man. What is that?
Well, there weren't any.
Really?
There were none for a long time. No, there really weren't. There was not that long ago, there was a website that would have the 40 most best-looking men or most attractive men, and I got to the mid-teens on that. And this wasn't that long ago. I mean, I lost my hair in my 20s, so I was it was me. I'm looking at me now.
You're all right.
Thank you very much. I carry myself with a certain je ne sais quoi, but I would certainly... I would be modest of saying that I shouldn't be ranking in a country's top 30 attractive men. Yeah. Oh, no, I got as far as 30, 31, because it's a running joke every year. I go, really? Really? Do we not have anyone better? And then people like Cillian Murphy have come along and have shaken up the thing by genetically being superior to all of us. But it's not a thing that we're, renowned
known
for. No. I mean, we're not. I think it rests uncomfortably with us. We don't want... Certain countries, like Swedes, carry beauty very, very
Italians.
Easily. Yeah, Italians, gorgeous. We're not comfortable with that, the Irish. That is not what we're about. But that there would be a class of us who are just stunningly beautiful, and then there would be an industry about gossip magazines about this incredibly beautiful. That's not
your thing.
It's not our thing. No.
Well, you're a beautiful person.
Thank you very much.
Right?
Thank you very much. Listen,
we can settle on that.
Yeah, but actually, you don't know. I'm of a terrible heart.
I've got no evidence. Although I've enjoyed my time with you. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
Dara O'Brien is in Brisbane tomorrow. joined us, of course, in the drawing room tonight. That's the 11th of September, Sydney on Friday, the 13th of September, and Melbourne on Monday.
Sydney on the 14th as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes, extra date. Because, oh, by the way, Brisbane sold out, first Sydney also sold out. I'm delighted to say this. So actually, the only place to go is that second date in Sydney.
Okay, the 14th of September.
Yes.
We're going to have to do this together now.
Yeah.
And Melbourne on Monday, the 16th of September.
Yes, in Hamer Hall.
All right, we're settled. We're middle-aged men.
Oh, listen.
Free to be.
Catch me before I disappear forever.
Yeah.
I'm the real minority here.
Endangered
Why is my voice not being heard?
Maybe not. That's it for RN Drive tonight. Thank you so much for your company.